This episode of Igalia Chats is brought to you by Igalia, an open source consultancy with a proven track record of landing features in devices from XR to handheld, deep expertise with embedded devices, advancements in flagship web browsers, kernel contributions, and much more. To get in touch or to learn more, visit igalia.com.
Okay, so hi, I am Brian Cordell. I'm a developer advocate at Igalia, and I am joined by a special guest today. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi, I'm Robin Burgin. I'm a freelance technologist working primarily in on problems of governance. It's a pleasure to be here.
Back here. You were on, I think, 9 or 10 episodes ago to talk about your rewilding the internet piece, which I thought was great. And somehow it stumbled me into some old blog posts, and I wanted to figure out like how quickly we could get back to here, because you wrote this piece in 2014 that was called Web 2024. Do you remember?
Yeah, I do remember.
I feel like maybe you could get some context about like why you wrote that piece, when you wrote it.
I think where it was coming from is we were about to ship HTML5, if memory serves. We were wrapping up the recommendation for that. It was also a time where I think it was the web's 25th anniversary, that working group's 10th anniversary, the W3C's 20th anniversary. These things line up with neat numbers. And so it felt like a time for reflection, and rather than thinking about how the web had evolved from 2004 to 2014, I thought like going forward might be interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was a great idea, and I seem to remember that other people also thought that was a neat idea and wrote some similar posts, but I couldn't actually find any very easily. So if you all know of some that are out there, share them, but we'll talk about this one because it's fun, because it is a time of reflection, and some of them will be pretty good guesses and other ones not so much. The way that prognostication goes, right? Like I have shared a bunch of times that Amazon and Google both, when they came out, I thought that is never going anywhere. You're never going to make money that way. But two of the most fantastically successful companies in the ever. So some of them will be bad, right? I mean, there are some famously bad predictions that I also stumbled across that were about this reflection in 2014. So people were like, hey, let's reflect on some things about the web that people made, since we're talking about this anniversary of the web. And one was Bill Gates said that spam will be gone within 2 years in 1994. and also somebody said like nobody will ever make any money on the internet. Also clearly very wrong. As we just said, those two companies are two of the most profitable, lucrative companies ever. So yeah, anyway, I thought it would be fun. So you wrote this piece that was predictions.
Yep, and you're right. It was that piece was surprisingly popular at the time. I think it was and might still be one of the blog posts I've written that was read the most, at least in a short period of time. I don't keep stats, so I don't remember the details, but it was in the hundreds of thousands of hits within a few days. And it was like picked up by, Smashing and a whole bunch of, venues with lots of developer outreach. And indeed, a lot of people did write about how they agreed with like maybe one thing and disagreed with 9 others and had their own protection. So it was quite fun. Actually, I had a notification in my calendar, which I set back then, for this year, this July, to get back to Simon St. Lawrence about those predictions, because I remember he disagreed with me quite strongly. I completely forget what about, and we were supposed to get a beer talk about it 10 years later. So I got the calendar notification. I sent him an email. I failed to reach him, unfortunately. But yeah, it was fun. It was a fun thing. And interestingly, that blog post actually landed me a job.
Right.
Because in there's a paragraph somewhere towards the end where I talk about how in this wonderful world of 2024, the scientific community has realized that using PDF is the dumbest thing ever and has finally switched to some good, you know, some decent formats involving HTML and semantics and stuff like that. And you know, because of that, the CEO of a small startup called Science.ai that was working on scholarly tooling reached out and offered me a job, which I took and moved to New York for at the time. So it was a pretty big deal, even though, as you might notice, we are in 2024 and PDF is still a pretty big thing in scholarly publishing. So I don't think we've reached that. I don't think that prediction has come to fruition, unfortunately.
There are some aspects of that are interesting, though. Like that same paragraph you say, linked with better support for MathML, specialized dialect of HTML eventually surfaced for scientific publishing and was recently made the default format of the archive. This is just quoting your, that's not a thing that actually happened, but it's not far, though. Like, it's not far. Like, they have a HTML format in archive that is this year, and it is in no small part because of greater support for MathML.
Yep.
I guess you could also say that a lot of PDF viewing is actually via like PDF.js.
Yep.
Which is, so it is still somehow in the browser in a weird way. But yeah, anyway, it's an interesting prediction that maybe is closer than you think. Like, I mean,
We're definitely closer than we were 10 years ago. MathML support has massively improved. That's certainly true. And that, you know, that's in great part thanks to Egalia, I believe, if I'm correct on that one. Sure. It's certainly true that the archive now supports HTML output. It is promising. When it comes to rendering PDF in the browser, I think that's a tribute to how powerful browser-based rendering has become. It's still somewhat sad because PDF as a document format is not very accessible, has very poor semantics, and is, you know, terrible for anything from mobile rendering to cutting and pasting. Even though we're rendering it in the browser, I wouldn't count that one as a success just yet.
Yeah, I think it's better than the situation was in 2014, but I still don't think it's good. I don't. Here's when I want a PDF. Never.
Same, but you know, if you want something that's downloadable, like I do most of my, you know, scholarly reading on my Remarkable, you need a package format that supports a number of features, and EPUB never broke that world, right?
Yeah, let's go back to talking about the because I think we'll come to some of that in the predictions. So one that you predicted was that there would be a rise in single page apps, and you were right. So nobody can see you laughing hysterically, but I can share that Robin is falling off his chair with laughter. Do you want to talk about what you said in the prediction, or do you want me to?
I did say that SPAs would become, you know, big, and I indeed they have. So, you know, that certainly matters. I did say that service workers and frameworks built on top of them would become big, and that I think that has been correct. Mm-hmm. However, I did imagine that as part of a world in which we would see a lot more JSON-based backends that could be interoperable between websites. That has not happened. So, you know, the idea being that you have an SPA that's basically just the shell for your website, and sort of like the backend has like some rich semantics that are not RDF, but like can be interchanged across websites. That hasn't happened at all. And also this idea that, you know, in the blog, I talk about the fact that there's basically no such thing as native. It's blurred completely between web and native. I don't think we're there either at this point.
Yeah, definitely not. But you made this observation that, like, yeah, actually everybody thinks of SPAs as a great match for applications, but, you know, they're actually a pretty good choice for content in a way because, you know, on my blog, you know, I write the content. The content is its own piece, and then it's just the shell around it. And like, why do I have to send this shell down the wire every time? I wonder why we haven't really addressed that. I mean, we have a few times opened issues about it, but we just seem to not.
I think essentially you could today build a website that way, right? If you leaned really hard into custom elements, it could work that way. People haven't built things that way quite yet. I'm not sure why, but it's feasible. I say that, and I haven't built my own blog that way, so you know, maybe.
I think it is interesting to think about because it feels very natural to think that way, but then as you start thinking about it, we always run into these difficulties, and it's like, well, you get this like Flash Fun style content, and then what happens if somebody pulls up? Do you need some way to have like a self-hosted version in the sense that like if somebody requests a fragment, should the page be smart enough to go, well, you don't have the outer shell yet, so I need to also give you that versus, you know, like it, I think it just gets complicated and we've not tackled it that way, but I don't know. It was an interesting prediction. And part of the reason why I bring it up is because you do say like people wound up with APIs around JSON that would be interoperable. And because of that also then wound up with like a real web of data, right? And I thought it was a nice touch that you said that virtually none of this data relied on the RDF data model or even JSON-LD, as publishers were for the most part unaware that such options were even available to them, let alone understood how they might help or work.
I mean, I think I wrote it, I'm sort of like guessing at what I was thinking back then, but like, I think the moment you start talking, or at least definitely in 2014, the moment you would start talking about web of data and how like, you know, everyone could publish data and might interoperate, people's minds, at least in the standard space, would go straight to RDF, right?
Mine did.
Right, yes. And the problem with RDF, and I would put it in the same bag as other technologies like SOAP, for instance, is that they are so general purpose and so lacking in opinionated approach to the problem that they're trying to solve that you end up basically having to bring your own opinions. And then when you bring your own opinions, you no longer interoperate well with others, or you have to do extra work that, you know, that the format itself doesn't provide you with. And so you're paying a lot of extra tax up front for features that you don't need or don't need yet or might never need. And if instead you're doing some really basic JSON and you haven't thought about how, you know, Burgeon.com might interoperate with Cardale.org, then, you know, you can write a very simple transformation if your data is not stupid to go from one to the other. And eventually maybe align on something that makes transformation easier or removes the need for it. And that's likely a much more organic, much more opinionated and based on experience way of reaching a solution than these sort of like general purpose toolkits.
Yeah, it's difficult too, because you're not, you're a step away from the real world for sure. I mean, you, no matter how much we try, there are only so many people who can afford to participate in standards. Do you know what I mean? Like it takes time. So you only get so many use cases, so many voices, so many opinions, and there's a lot of curveballs out there. Like, I mean, I think as everybody knows, and like we have some people at least who are very, very good at predicting those and helping us avoid the pitfalls, but it's, you know, hard to impossible to make stuff preemptively like that. And so I remember reading this and thinking like, yes, I love it, because this is what I was advocating. We should focus on, like we should refocus standards on figuring this out, right? Like, how do we let things organically bloom and then recognize when there are opportunities to align the stuff that already exists, you know, the 27 different approaches that are very, very close, but different, to talk to one another and make agreements to become interoperable. I thought custom elements would give us this.
It might. It still might, you know.
Yeah. But it's relevant because actually in 2014, you and I both gave a talk with Marcos Caceres. Not a talk. We led a session, a breakout session at TPAC that was called After Five. Remember that?
Yep.
And then I was given the sort of AC badge for jQuery, and I made a plea to W3C to start thinking about this. Like, how do we be monitoring the situation and as it develops and help it toward agreement, and then write it down, like make it official. It is actually, in a lot of cases, the way that W3C worked historically. Nobody just admitted it, because, you know, the early HTMLs, there was a lot of effort to standardize stuff, but in the end, a lot of it was ultimately writing down what
it was there. Yeah. Yeah. And I think your efforts and the efforts of a few others were quite successful in bringing the jQuery kind of feature set to the DOM, right? The people who use the DOM today might not realize just how clunky it used to be to get anything done, like in vanilla DOM. It used to be extremely painful. Nowadays, I haven't even thought of using a library on top of the DOM when I need to manipulate the DOM, right? There's still other things, like having, you know, a virtual DOM and having, like, you know, an update lifecycle that makes sense for custom elements where you want to use a library. So I tend to use like lit HTML, for instance, quite a fair bit, because it fills in those gaps nicely. And I really wish we standardized some of that stuff. But like, if I want to manipulate the DOM, I just like hit the DOM and it's really easy. And that's because it basically like did what you just said and like stole, you know, features from jQuery left, right, and center. Just the basics, not even like a crazy amount, but just like the thinking and the approach of like, hey, you know, maybe methods can have an arbitrary number of arguments, and it doesn't matter. If you want to append multiple elements, just like put those three damn elements in there and it'll append them, right? And that was moving away from the idea of a DOM that had to work for Java and C Sharp and like whatever else, to a DOM that was like an in-browser thing where we could actually use JavaScript and therefore match the idioms. So I thought that was very successful.
Yeah. That I just want to point out that is also one of your predictions. At some point, someone underwent the epiphany that enabling developers to produce high performance content is at least as important as the raw performance of the runtime itself. This finally led to DOM to catch up to jQuery in terms of usability and making it possible to live without it and thereby remove its loading impact. So A+ on that one.
So, I mean, the jQuery part, yes, but the part where we, you know, people don't no longer load a framework.
Yeah, true. Fair. But like, to be fair too, though, you do, like, even if you rewind this podcast, unless we cut it, you did talk about how you predicted that frameworks would spring up around like SPAs and things. And right. So I don't think the problem is loading a framework, because I do think that the web itself has to be generic in the way, a little bit the way that you were saying, where like if it's too generic, you have to solve too many things. I think that inevitably some kind of frameworks are probably inevitable. Like,
right. Yeah. I do think it makes sense to need frameworks, because frameworks bring something that you wouldn't want a browser to do, in the sense that a good framework will be opinionated about things like your lifecycle and the such. That being said, I think we could lighten up that some frameworks. I think
definitely
supporting some VDOM directly in the browser could help there. Some very basic forms of templating, the kind like that Lit has, for instance, would also be pretty useful. But yeah, no, you're right. Like, frameworks, I think, are unavoidable. I think the question is, how do we make them as lightweight as possible?
You had another one in here that I feel like might be related to that, which is the same ability to pre-process arbitrary content before it is loaded applies to audio and video, which, given the performance now available, has become essentially JS self-decodable formats, putting an end to the seemingly endless stranglehold of the codec IP mafia. So is this web codecs that you're talking about?
Yeah, no, I mean, we're headed there. And, you know, you could also think of just like pure WASM as a way of implementing that. I think we're essentially largely there. The situation, you know, 10 years ago was really like everything's like Flash and real video. I mean, it is Flash had already like started dying in earnest, but
yeah,
it was still controversial to talk about native video, in part because that led to the entire EME and DRM discussions. But so a lot of content out there was not native HTML video. So the codecs issue was really key. I think you're right that this is smoothed over in the intervening years. I don't hear people complaining about video and audio codecs as much today.
Definitely, right? Definitely. Are we in a place where you could use WASM and web codecs to like make it popular in the first place? Or is that like a...
I mean, it would probably still be quite rough. One way to think about it is, and because you were involved in that, if you had to do responsive images today, what would you need from the browser in order to get that kind of rendering done right? Because if we're talking image formats, preloading a WASM, using that to decode a format and somehow converting that format to pixels seems feasible. It might be clunky, but it might have some rough edges, right?
Yeah.
If you want to support any kind of like image format, you might need something nasty, like having your image decoder be able to talk back to the network layer. For instance, if you want to support like wavelet images that have multiple built-in resolutions and you wanted to render them yourself, right? You do need to request more bytes, right? But yeah, I don't know. It could be interesting. It would be fun to try and to see what works and what's rough about it.
It's a tricky one, right? Because I think that people would make a lot of arguments, like there were arguments made by like Kixie, even like if the web natively supported audio and video, it would be like such this huge boon, and like you can have this streaming and this is very efficient and blah blah blah. But like in practice, a lot of the industry chunks the video themselves, and they like use this complicated like JavaScript to manage that, and like it's not just HTTP range requests and all that native stuff. Like I think that they do that for performance.
Probably, yes.
For their own. We actually should have some people on from Igalia's multimedia team to talk about that, because that's an interesting thing. Let's go back to predictions. So you also made a prediction that was related to DRM.
Yeah, I mean, that was completely wrong. We still have DRM. We just don't fight as much about it anymore, right?
It was a hot topic in 2014.
It was really hot in 2014. I really wish we'd figured out a better way of managing that. I think it's interesting because in parallel at the time, you had a DRM push for like audio video in the browser, and you had a DRM push for EPUB. And the audio video one like really fully succeeded. And the EPUB one, like DRM got blocked, and the working group like refused to support DRM EPUB. The difference between those two is quite interesting. In the EPUB one, there was zero civil society involvement. Like we didn't have like, you know, a bunch of like EFF people protesting it. It was just like managed internally, but we managed to very effectively get enough implementers against it and enough like publishers against it as well that it was blocked. In the main one, the one that was like highly debated, we had this crazy setup where the people I would like agree with, you know, like EFF and all those folks were mad at W3C even though W3C cannot make those decisions, right? It doesn't matter.
Yeah,
they were fighting completely moral but ineffectual battles, because like the people to push back against would have been, you know, Google and Apple and Microsoft, you know, Netflix and whoever was pushing it. Every time I brought that up, the answer was like, oh, but those are too big, we can't fight them. And so you ended up with people pushing against W3C, which was not the fulcrum of power. And, you know, going to MIT and taking protest selfies in front of the W3C office, which is, you know, just about as useless as it gets. And then, unsurprisingly, the mobilization failed because it was pushing back on the wrong thing.
Yeah, I think 2015, I guess, we were in Portugal for TPAC. Does that sound right?
It's probably right. I was no longer involved in W3C at that point. So
that was still going on then. And I remember there were like literally worldwide protests at this point about this. But like you say, they were protesting like W3C events. And I went and talked to like people who were protesting. I went and talked to them because I was like, why does it bother you that W3C wrote it down? Because they're just saying like, it exists. It is already mostly interoperable. We should acknowledge that and formalize it and write it down and make it as maybe unfortunately good as we can. And then also it's good that it brings in a lot of players who would ultimately otherwise be just competitors with the web. Like they would be pushing to be complete competitors with the web.
And also, you know, make it royalty free so that you know, open source implementations can support it.
Exactly.
And also bring accessibility requirements mm-hmm. to the center. I very much sympathize with people being angry about this. I mean, DRM really sucks. Like I recently moved from the US to Europe, and you know, I lost a bunch of things that I thought I'd bought because they were DRM'd and DRM'd for a region. That kind of thing should be illegal. Like the people who do that kind of stuff, and I'm looking at you, Spotify, should go to jail for that kind of stuff, right? But it's legal and it's how the world works. And the W3C's current setup, as you said, is largely voluntary. It's not entirely voluntary, but it's largely voluntary. And it certainly doesn't have the kind of power to prevent DRM, unfortunately, as that might be. So yeah, I was hoping that people would catch that. I was hoping that those people would use the patents process to block deployment, because that would have been a very interesting use of IP. I was hoping that they would protest the people actually making it happen, but no, mm-hmm. this sort of like misunderstanding of how power works in the digital space was, I think, unfortunate and also very revealing of, you know, the lack of understanding of how, you know, internet governance and digital governance works in general.
You predicted that in the late 2010s, someone would implement a complete XSL FO processor in pure CSS, and that the publishing industry switched to full web standards and drank champagne.
I don't think that has happened, but I think you could. I think you actually could.
I think that you could, especially now that we have HAS. There's like pretty close parity with maybe not everything, because there are still a few things selector wise that are just can't do with CSS, but I think, like, for 90% of existing code, it probably wouldn't matter.
And XSLFO doesn't require a lot of very complex selector processing, I think, because it really is a representation of a rendering tree, right?
Yeah.
And so not that I would spend time on it, but I think it's entirely feasible. You could get very close. I'm convinced you could get very close to that. No one's done it because no one cares, but you could get very close. It would be a fun project.
You had a whole industry of applications built atop network service discovery, make it possible to control how your camera can tell your car to produce the best amount of color lighting for a dusk shot, and a host of other vital inter-device interactions.
Yeah, none of that's happened at all.
I don't think that happened. But you did have this thing about the TV industry, and I don't know, how do you feel about this? Because honestly, like, a lot of the TV industry is at least using embedded browsers. And I can't tell from reading your thing if it's like it has become an example of what you said was the bad thing, or if it's kind of moved forward, like we're in a better place now.
Yeah, I think things have largely not changed that much. I mean, what I was probably thinking of at the time was much more to do with proper web apps on TV surfaces. Mm-hmm. But I don't think apps on TVs have taken off at all. You could see that, you know, Netflix is its own app and like Disney Plus is its own app and all that. But like, those are not very interesting apps. They're just like, you know, a million different bad renditions of access to a catalog and a video player on top. So I think this hasn't happened because actually no one wants an app on their TV, and they're probably right about that.
Okay. So yeah, what other predictions did you make? Do you remember?
I mean, I think we've covered most of them apart from like a completely gratuitous jab at PHP dying.
Right.
I think PHP is large. I mean, it's probably still huge in some places, but I don't think it has much growth.
No, the one that we totally missed was the very first one. It says, not only do all browsers have large chunks of themselves implemented in JavaScript, but at some point, someone started a pure JS browser from scratch. It was initially meant as a joke, but this Inception browser caught the fancy of ever resourceful JS community and quickly grew in usability. The sheer inventiveness of its interface and flexibility of its feature set conspired to make it one of the top dogs in today's browser market. I guess we should mention that, like, you wrote this as if you were writing it in 2024, although you were writing it in 2014. So do we have that? I don't know.
I don't think we have that. I think a couple people started. I know there have been projects.
In a weird way, it is kind of true, but not in probably the way that you meant, because parts of most of the browsers are totally implemented in JavaScript.
Right.
The setting screens and like all of those things.
Most of the UI, a lot of the time.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like most of the like UI things, like your bookmarks bar and all that kind of stuff. But I think that was like partially true in 2014 as well. Like, I mean, the Firefox is all Zool, right? And but yeah, I don't think we got that. Although we did get, I don't know if you listened to our episode a while recently, but it was on the POR4 engine. Do you know about
that? I do not.
So it is a JavaScript engine written in JavaScript. So maybe it's gonna be a thing. And there are a lot of browsers that are like kind of Electron app browsers, and you could make the case that parts of them are.
I think the fun thing to try, I think it should be possible, would be to transpile Sovo to JavaScript, because I think Rust to JavaScript is quite feasible.
Interesting.
And then, you know, see what kind of performance you get, and see if that leads to anything. Obviously, that prediction was wrong, but I think I was right on something, which is that if it were to happen, it would start off as a kind of a joke, you know, or you know, at least a dare, or it's like, yeah, you know, screw you, I'm going to do JavaScript and JavaScript kind of thing. And then if it succeeds, it'll be because it took off from the joke thing, right? So I think if someone has nothing to do over the weekend, they could try transpiling Sovo to. I don't think it would work from a C++ code base. I think that would be ambitious, but like transpiling from Rust to JavaScript is probably feasible, and you might get something that actually works, surprisingly enough.
You also had a prediction here that there would be some kind of like merging of like a JSON and the web form model. That would then lead to kind of like a web schema. I don't know if that has happened in like in the wild, but it sounds pretty good to me, actually.
It's funny because like I wrote a thing called web schema something like 10-ish years ago. I forget if it was before that blog post or after. And I did work on it as something that was designed to have like a complete loop. My theory, and I still believe that, is that if you have a validation system that only does validation, then no one's going to use it.
Right.
It also has to do UI generation and other things so that it is in the usage loop and people notice when things go wrong. And so I do think that's something that ties together forms and validation and content generation and all that. There's a usability sweet spot in there that, that should be possible to hit. I also think that that was hard to implement in a flexible, interesting way 10 years ago because custom elements weren't quite there yet. I think with today's much more HTML-centric systems, we could do something much more powerful and much more flexible. So I think this could be done, and I think it's worth doing. There is some of it in that, for instance, you know, a lot of people use VS Code, and in VS Code, if you have a JSON file with a JSON schema linked from it, you will get all the hinting in the editing. It's still very developer-oriented, but it's, you know, it's better than nothing. And the next layer up is, of course, making that available to people more generally. But I think that hasn't happened, but I think it's feasible. And it's funny, I get questions about these things, you know, once a year or so. So people are thinking about it at a like slow drip, essentially.
So I think that we have gone through all the predictions, but it's a fun article. Like, we'll link it, and if people want to read it, you're a good writer. And you have you like to read a similar kind of sense of tone and humor as I do. So you tend to write that way. So I always enjoy it. I think there's a bit of Douglas Adams-y humor in your writing. So
very high praise. Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for coming on, Robin. It's always fun.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure. Yeah. Great conversation. Thank you, Brian.
Thanks.